Thursdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico suffered life-threatening injuries when he was shot in an attempted assassination on Wednesday. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino reports.
Fico was in the central town of Hanlova for a government meeting and was shaking hands with a crowd of people when a man near a barricade pulled out a gun and fired. Slovak media said the shooter was a 71-year-old man, though the motive was initially unclear. The country's interior minister said it was, quote, politically motivated. The 59-year-old was rushed to a local hospital and then transported by helicopter to a regional capital for urgent treatment. Slovakia's president Zuzana Čaputová said she was shocked by the shooting, saying it was, quote, an attack on democracy.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday told Chinese media he is prepared to negotiate an end to the Ukraine conflict on the eve of his visit to China. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma reports.
The official Xinhua news agency quotes Putin saying, "We're open to a dialogue, but such negotiations must take into account the interests of all countries involved in the conflict, including ours." Putin adds, "Moscow is seeking a comprehensive, sustainable and just settlement of this conflict through peaceful means." His trip comes as Russian forces have pressed their offensive in northeast Ukraine's Kharkiv region. China claims to take a neutral position in the conflict, but has backed Moscow in real terms. I'm Charles Deledesma.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday fended off criticism he is not planning for a post-war reality in the Gaza Strip, saying it's impossible to prepare for any scenario in the Palestinian enclave until it can defeat Hamas. This is VOA News. Netanyahu has faced increasing pressure from critics at home and allies abroad, especially the United States, to present a post-war plan for Gaza. Meanwhile, Palestinians on Wednesday marked the 76th anniversary of their mass expulsion from what is now Israel in the war surrounding the country's creation in 1948. In an interview with the Associated Press, Palestinian refugee Dawood Assad said a trench near his home was helpful when he and his Palestinian refugees needed to flee Israeli forces during what is known as the Nakba.
So when the Zionists attacked us on April 1948, we happened to have like a trench on the road, and that trench saved actually a lot of people, give them a chance to escape from the west side of the village.
Nakba is the Arabic word for a catastrophe. Some 700,000 Palestinians fled or were forced to flee from what is now Israel. More than twice that number have been displaced within Gaza since the start of the Israel-Hamas war, which was triggered when militants from Gaza attacked Israel on October 7th. Doctors in Gaza said on Wednesday they are struggling to provide medical treatment, and many patients can't leave for treatment abroad because the southern Rafah crossing is closed. Here's Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder.
Gaza's medical system has virtually collapsed, witnesses say. Egypt blames the closure on Israeli military operations around Rafah. Israel, which seized control of the crossing last week, said on Tuesday it was up to Egypt to reopen it. Remarks described by Cairo as desperate attempts to shift the blame, as well as shutting down a vital evacuation route for patients in Gaza. The shutdown has left desperately needed foreign aid piling up on the Egyptian side of the border.
That was Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. U.S. security officials said that foreign adversaries will once again seek to influence the upcoming U.S. elections during a congressional hearing Wednesday. AP's Lisa Dwyer reports.
It is now easier and cheaper than ever to create lifelike images, video, and audio that can fool even the most discerning voter. Other tools of disinformation include state media, online influencers, and networks of fake accounts that can quickly amplify false and misleading content. Russia, China, and Iran remain the main actors looking to interfere with the upcoming election. During the hearing, top security officials did say that the U.S. has greatly improved its ability to safeguard election security and to identify and combat foreign disinformation campaigns. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Follow us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at VOAnews.com, as well as on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and X, formerly known as Twitter, and download our VOA News app. I'm Richard Green for
VOA News.
Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico shot on the street. U.S. to NATO, prepare for confrontation with Russia.
I think that there's a little bit of a misperception that we have time and that Russia's taken a lot of losses and it's going to take them a while to rebuild and reconstitute. I don't have that view.
And the Banksy Museum has opened in New York City.
This is the largest exhibition in the world, over 160 pieces by Banksy, and the only place in the world where you can see everything that he's ever done.
Today is Thursday, May 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico has suffered life-threatening injuries, shot in an attempted assassination on Wednesday. The shooting caught on video, a man in the crowd pulling a gun and getting off five shots before being tackled to the ground by police and security. Slovak media said the shooter was a 71-year-old man. The country's interior minister said the shooting was politically motivated. The 59-year-old Fico was rushed to a local hospital and then transported by helicopter to a regional capital for urgent treatment. Fico is no longer in life-threatening condition. World leaders reacted quickly, condemning the shooting, including U.S. President Joe Biden.
The president expressed his alarm and deep concern over the attack. As the president said, he and Dr. Biden are praying for a swift recovery, and our thoughts are with his family and the people of Slovakia. We condemn this horrific act of violence, and our embassy is in close touch with the government and ready to assist.
Fico has drawn criticism for taking a more pro-Russian stance in the Ukraine war, as well as initiating reforms of criminal law and the media, which have raised concerns over weakening the rule of law. As Russia ramps up its offensive in eastern Ukraine, officials with the U.S. command in Eastern Europe say it's urgent for NATO to be ready for a confrontation. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Marislava Gongadza talked to the U.S. and Polish commanders in Bolesławiec, Poland.
10,000 U.S. troops are on rotation in Poland, a NATO front line. This week, the 1st Cavalry Division of the U.S. Army assumed control from the 3rd Infantry Division for the Eastern European mission. The U.S. military is working closely with NATO allies to strengthen deterrence. In 2020, it reactivated its V-Corps, enhancing command and control for U.S. allied and partner forces in Europe. Lieutenant General Charles Costanza, the commanding general of V-Corps, who recently assumed leadership of the corps, says Russia represents a near-term threat to NATO.
I think that there's a little bit of a misperception that we have time and that Russia's taken a lot of losses and it's going to take them a while to rebuild and reconstitute. I don't have that view, and I think we need to be ready in the near term.
Ukrainian officials and Western open-source intelligence reports say Russia's losses in Ukraine have been heavy, with nearly 50,000 troops killed in action. But Costanza says Russia forces are swiftly rebuilding themselves, and while they are not as well-trained as NATO troops, they have grown in size since the start of their full-scale invasion.
Also modernized, learning the lessons from fighting in Ukraine, which is going to be a problem for us in the West because Ukraine's using Western equipment. They are using Western techniques. Russia's learning how to defeat that.
He sees a real sense of urgency for NATO to be ready. The Polish partners concur and express their welcome to U.S. troops. Poland has always seen Russia as a threat, but Brigadier General Fajkowski, commander of the Polish Army's 11th Armored Cavalry Division, says all NATO allies now recognize the severity of that threat.
Now when Russia invaded Ukraine, all masks are out. So now we know everything. Russian shows how they think, how they conquer, how they operate, and everything now is clear.
He stresses how important it is for Poland to have U.S. troops stationed on its territory as a deterrent.
We have to be ready to show the Russians that, look, we are prepared. There is no way to invite us. If you invite even the smallest country like Latvia or Estonia, we are ready to face the threat.
Polish military officials stress that throughout history and due to its geographic location in the heart of Europe, their country has often had to fight first. One reason, it currently spends almost 4% of its GDP on defense. The memories of Nazi occupation in World War II and Soviet domination in the period after taught Poland some painful lessons. Providing support for Ukraine now and helping train Ukrainian soldiers are signs that Poland is choosing to apply the lessons of the past wars to avoid suffering new ones. Mirosława Gongadze, VOA News, Bolesławiec, Poland.
Tens of thousands of people are taking to the streets of Tbilisi, Georgia, in protest of the parliament's passage Tuesday of what critics call a Russian-style foreign agent law. The ruling party approved the legislation, which they said was to prevent interference in the country's politics, despite warnings from Washington and Brussels that such a move might threaten Georgia's partnership with the West. VOA Georgian Services' Ani Chigbadze has more details from Tbilisi.
Hundreds of protesters donning gas masks and protective goggles shut down streets in Tbilisi after Georgia's parliament passed a foreign influence bill.
We are going to fight for our future. This law is really pro-Russian law, and this law hinders our path to Europe, and we are going to fight till the end.
The bill requires any groups receiving more than 20% of their funding from abroad to register as agents of foreign influence. The government says it's needed to prevent foreign interference, but critics call it a Russian-style threat to stifle free speech. Washington and Brussels say the actions threaten Tbilisi's relationship with the West. For over a month, Georgian protesters have taken to the streets in the largest rallies the country of 3.7 million people has seen since it gained independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. Protesters see the government's move as a tilt towards Russia.
If the law goes forward without conforming to EU norms, and this kind of rhetoric and aspersions against the U.S. and other partners continue, I think the relationship is at risk.
Georgian authorities have arrested dozens of protesters over the past few days.
Purpose and aim is the only one. We don't want to go back to SSSR, I mean Soviet Union. We don't want to go there. That's why everyone, no matter if students or older people, young people, everywhere, everyone is here. Because we are fighting for one aim. We have only one goal. To this government, this pro-Russian government. We don't want them.
Over the years, Tbilisi has maintained a strategic ambiguity when it comes to foreign policy, working with the West to appease its overwhelmingly pro-European population, but warming to Moscow at the same time. The bill now goes to President Salome Zurabishvili, who has vowed to veto the legislation. But the ruling Georgian Green Party has a majority sufficient to override it. Zurabishvili has 14 days to act. Ani Chikwadze, VOA News, Tbilisi, Georgia.
And one more note on the push and pull between the West and Russia. Moldova's Justice Ministry asked a Chisinau court on Wednesday to place restrictions on the political activities by the pro-Russian Chance Party. It opposes the government's drive for the ex-Soviet state to join the European Union by 2030. The party is linked to fugitive business magnate Elon Shore, who was sentenced to 15 years in prison in absentia last year on charges in connection with the disappearance of $1 billion from the Moldovan banking system in 2014. Shore lives in Israel, and Moldova has repeatedly sought his extradition. following these other stories from around the world, Russian President Vladimir Putin is in Beijing on a two-day state visit to China. Putin's visit comes as Russia's become more economically dependent on China following Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 2 years ago. On the eve of the visit, Putin said the Kremlin is prepared to negotiate over the conflict in Ukraine in an interview he did with Chinese media. Peruvian President Dina Boluarte will travel to China in June to meet with President Xi Jinping. Her agriculture minister announced on Wednesday that beef exports to China are among the topics likely to be on the agenda. A U.S. judge on Wednesday rejected Tesla's bid to dismiss a lawsuit accusing Tesla of misleading owners into believing that their cars could soon have self-driving capabilities. The proposed nationwide class action accused Tesla and owner Elon Musk of having, since 2016, falsely advertised autopilot and other self-driving technology as functional or just around the corner, inducing drivers to pay more for their cars. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump traded barbs online on social media while agreeing to debate each other in person at least twice prior to the November general election. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, in Washington.
CNN reports the Democratic Party incumbent and the Republican challenger are scheduled to debate on June 27th, while ABC says a second Trump-Biden debate will be held on September 10th. The announcements came within hours of the president and his predecessor taunting each other about debates. Biden, in a video posted to social media platforms, said Trump lost two debates to him in 2020 and is now acting like he wants to meet again.
Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice. So let's pick the dates, Donald. I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
Trump currently does not have to be in court in New York City on Wednesdays during his criminal hush money trial. That trial is likely to conclude before next month's first scheduled debate. Trump on his Truth Social platform responded he's ready and willing to debate and wants more encounters than the June and September dates. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson's decision not to invite Kenyan President William Ruto to a joint meeting of Congress when he comes to Washington later this month has disappointed a lot of people. VOA's Carol Van Dam has more.
Kenya is a key U.S. ally in Africa and is seen as a bulwark in heading off Russia's influence in eastern Africa. Many in Washington were hoping to see Ruto invited to speak before a joint meeting of Congress when he arrives in Washington on May 23rd for a state visit, marking the 60th anniversary of U.S.-Kenyan diplomatic relations. Republican Michael McCaul, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, urged House Speaker Mike Johnson to extend the invitation to Ruto. He and Democrat Gregory Meeks wrote, "It would underscore the importance of the U.S.-Kenya relationship and send a valuable signal to the people of Africa." Raj Shah, Speaker Johnson's chief of staff, said it mostly boiled down to a scheduling conflict. He told VOA that, quote, "It is really an issue of floor time and not intended to be in any way a slight to Kenya as a U.S. ally." David Monda, a Kenyan and professor of political science at City University of New York, told VOA that he thinks Johnson's decision had more to do with appealing to the right wing of his party.
Mike Johnson, the speaker, is really attempting to show the right wing members of his coalition, particularly the Freedom Caucus, that he's not going to give in to all the Democratic request.
Joanna LeBlanc, a lawyer and partner at the Washington, D.C. firm Adami Advisory Group, calls it a missed opportunity to strengthen U.S.-Kenyan ties, adding it's been over a decade since an African head of state addressed Congress.
I can understand from a political standpoint why Speaker Johnson
would not approve this, right? Let's be honest. It's an election year, and it's one that has proven itself to be very contentious.
Shaw says not inviting Ruto was more a consequence of the congressional schedule. He also noted that Johnson has offered the Kenyan embassy over 90 minutes of engagement, including a one-on-one visit with Johnson and a bipartisan leadership meeting with committee chairs and ranking members. Joint meetings require a considerable amount of planning on Capitol Hill. The chamber is shut down for hours, and such an event entails a major security operation. In addition, Ruto arrives on a Thursday, just ahead of the U.S. Memorial Day holiday. Members of Congress typically are not in Washington on Fridays and generally return to their home districts for several days around national holidays. Still, some foreign leaders have appeared before joint meetings of Congress in the past year, including Japanese Minister Fumio Kishida, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and Israeli President Isaac Herzog. VOA reached out to the Kenyan embassy for its response, but did not hear back. Shaw tells VOA there is always what he calls a back and forth with embassies about the level of engagement, and that the speaker would like to accommodate all requests, but a joint session of Congress is what he calls a pretty rare event. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. That's the protest anthem called Glory to Hong Kong. It has been banned by Chinese courts. Now, YouTube says it will comply with the court decision and block access inside Hong Kong to 32 video links deemed prohibited content. Critics say it's a blow to freedom. Thousands of Palestinians marched in Gaza and Israel to commemorate the Nakba, the catastrophe of their mass dispossession in the 1948 war surrounding Israel's creation. Here's Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder with more.
Peace signs and a minute's silence. Palestinians and their supporters around the world commemorated the 1948 Nakba, or catastrophe, on Wednesday in the shadow of war in Gaza. These keys symbolize the homes hundreds of thousands of dispossessed Palestinians lost in the war when Israel was founded. The Nakba has been a defining experience for Palestinians for more than 75 years, helping to shape their national identity. 80-year-old Umm Mohammed survived the original Nakba as a child. After losing her home in the latest war, like nearly all Gazans, she shelters in a tent in the southern city of Rafah, where Israeli tanks are massed on the eastern edges ahead of a feared offensive.
There is no catastrophe worse than this one. I've been here for about 80 years, and a catastrophe like this I have not seen. Our homes have gone, our children have gone, our property has gone, our gold has gone, our incomes have gone. Nothing is left. What is left for us to cry over?
The seven-month-old Israeli campaign has reduced much of the Gaza Strip to rubble and killed more than 35,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry. Many Gazans fear being driven from the enclave in a second Nakba.
It's been a Nakba for the past 76 years. It's not new. We have many other catastrophes in villages, and the most recent of them is the Nakba we see in Gaza.
The May 15th Nakba Day commemoration marks the start of the 1948 war, when neighboring Arab states invaded a day after Israel declared its independence, following the withdrawal of British forces from what was then called Palestine. The fighting lasted for months and cost thousands of lives. Descendants of the Palestinians who remained in Israel call for their kin to be allowed to return, something Israel rejects. Daya Dan, an activist from the Israeli city of Haifa, marched with them.
I'm here to show solidarity with my Palestinian brothers and sisters and to protest the right to return to their stolen land.
Nearly 6 million Palestinians are currently registered as refugees in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, according to the United Nations, in addition to populations scattered across the world.
Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. And finally, the artist Banksy, whose real name and identity isn't known, is an English-based street artist. He's been active since the 1990s. His art is satirical and combines subversive dark humor with graffiti. His works of political and social commentary have appeared on streets and walls, bridges, all over the world. Now, there's a Banksy Museum in New York City.
This is the largest exhibition in the world, over 160 pieces by Banksy, and the only place in the world where you can see everything that he's ever done.
That's William Mead, the executive director of the Banksy Museum.
Banksy is one of the most unusual artists because not only is he elusive in terms of who and what he is, but also he was never, no one knows exactly where he came from or where he's doing, and so to this day, nobody actually knows his identity.
And the thing is, for most of Banksy's art, the only place you can see it now is in this museum.
Most of the pieces in here have either been destroyed because they've been defaced, or they've been destroyed because of the buildings, or because they were created in war zones. Out of the 30 pieces that were created in 2013, only one still exists.
The pieces take on familiar Banksy topics, including war and peace, and economic inequality and terrorism. Populated throughout are the usual Banksy images, including rats and children and protesters.
Every time that I look at these pieces, I see something different. And I think depending on who you are, that's the wonderful thing about this exhibition is that adults see one thing, children see something else. I think it's a multi-generational thing. So on one hand, you may see a ballerina dancing on cement, or, you know, on the other hand, other people don't see that at all. In other words, sometimes people see this is just a little girl letting go of a balloon, but then other people see it as a loss of innocence, a loss of, you know, giving away, you know, the parts of themselves. And so each piece has a dramatically different thing, but there's no doubt Banksy has a tremendously in touch and in tune with all of the things that are going on, such as the Palestine and Ukraine. He'll create art all in conjunction with each one of those.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On May 10th, the 193-member United Nations General Assembly voted on a resolution to grant new rights and privileges of a member state to Palestine, an observer state. The Assembly also voted to recommend that the Security Council take another look at Palestine's request for UN membership. By passing the resolution, the UN General Assembly determined that Palestine is qualified for membership. The resolution passed with 143 votes, well over the 118 necessary for approval. The United States was one of 9 member states that voted against it. That's because the adoption of the resolution will not bring about a tangible change for Palestinians. Sustainable peace in the region can be achieved only through a two-state solution, with Israel's security guaranteed, where Israelis and Palestinians can live side by side with equal measures of freedom and dignity, said Robert Wood, United States Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs. It remains the U.S. view that unilateral measures at the UN and on the ground will not advance this goal.
Our vote does not reflect opposition to Palestinian statehood. We have been very clear that we support it and seek to advance it meaningfully. Instead, it is an acknowledgement that statehood will come only from a process that involves direct negotiations between the parties.
There is no other path that guarantees Israel's security and future as a democratic Jewish state, said Ambassador Wood. There is no other path that guarantees Palestinians can live in peace with dignity in a state of their own. And there is no other path that leads to regional integration between Israel and all its Arab neighbors.
The United States is committed to intensifying its engagement with the Palestinians and the rest of the region to advance a political settlement that will create a path to Palestinian statehood and subsequent membership in the United Nations.
The United States will continue to oppose measures that undermine the prospect of a two-state solution, said Ambassador Wood. We believe a two-state solution is the best way to achieve a durable peace in the region, along with security for Israelis and Palestinians. It remains the U.S. view that the most expeditious path towards statehood and U.N. membership for the Palestinian people is through direct negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, with the support of the United States and other partners.
That was an editorial.